You know, when we think about professional events, those massive industry conferences, or even just a high-stakes corporate webinar, there is this baseline expectation of, well, absolute polish.
Oh, definitely.
It's a lot like going to a symphony, right?
Yeah, you expect the musicians to be perfectly in tune.
Exactly. The conductor is perfectly coordinated, the lighting is just right. I mean, everyone hits the exact same beat.
It's an entirely orchestrated experience down to the minute.
Right. There's this rigid structure we've all just kind of agreed upon.
Yeah, we expect the welcome emails to be perfectly timed, the slide decks to be flawless.
And the speakers have their talking points memorized down to the syllable.
Carefully rehearsed.
Yeah.
Polished until it practically blinds you.
And, well, we like it that way. I mean, nobody sets aside their Tuesday afternoon or pays good money for a VIP ticket to watch the symphony just drop their instruments, lose their sheet music, and nervously sweat under the stage lights.
No, of course not.
We crave that visible competence. It makes us feel safe. It tells us, you know, we are in good hands.
That safety is the product they're actually selling, really.
Oh, that's a good point.
The information is almost secondary to the feeling of being guided by an expert who has everything completely under control.
Right. But then you hit play on today's source material, and suddenly you are very, very far away from the symphony.
Yeah, you really are.
In fact, you aren't even in the concert hall anymore. Instead, I want you to imagine you are listening to a guy heavily panting on an elliptical machine.
Which is just such a funny mental image.
It is. He's occasionally pausing to catch his breath, apologizing for probably annoying his neighbors. And between these labored breaths, he is casually pitching what sounds like, honestly, the absolute worst idea for a professional event in recorded history.
It is the absolute definition of professional self-sabotage, just captured raw and unedited.
Welcome to our deep dive into the source material for today. We are looking at a truly fascinating mid-June audio recording from a man named Bradley Charbonneau. He is the founder of a program called The Worst Book Ever. And in this very sweaty, impromptu recording, he's outlining his pitch for an online event scheduled for August 1st, 2026.
And the official title?
The Worst Summit Ever.
Which just, it's incredible. And while the premise itself is entirely absurd, he is completely serious about executing it.
He really is. He is fully committed to the bit.
He's all in.
So that is our mission for you today. We are going to unpack this seemingly crazy methodology of intentionally designing a massive, undeniable failure.
Yeah. Because if you have a project you've been putting off,
Maybe a book you want to write,
or a business you want to launch, or even just a difficult presentation you need to draft,
we want to explore how doing absolutely everything wrong might actually be the ultimate psychological hack to get unstuck and start creating.
because on the surface, I mean, it sounds like a joke, right? Like a parody of the whole creator economy.
Totally.
But underneath the heavy breathing on that elliptical, there is a very sophisticated approach to overcoming creative paralysis.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can really understand why someone would willingly do this to themselves and their audience, we need to appreciate the sheer hilarious lengths Bradley is going to in order to ensure this summit is a complete disaster.
Oh, yeah. We are looking at a meticulous blueprint for guaranteed failure.
He is incredibly systematic about it, isn't he?
He really is. He is looking at every single best practice for hosting an online event and deliberately, surgically doing the exact opposite.
Let's start with the timing. He specifically chooses August 1st.
Right.
He explicitly says on the recording that this is the middle of summer, right in the middle of school vacations. It is, quote, the wrong time to do it.
The absolute worst time.
But he doesn't stop there. He suggests scheduling the live sessions for the middle of the night in certain countries,
Which is just brilliant.
just to guarantee that his core audience literally cannot access the content.
What's fascinating here is how he is weaponizing logistics.
Weaponizing logistics, I like that.
Usually, event organizers are tearing their hair out looking for the perfect overlapping time zone window. You know, they're analyzing their email lists, trying to find that magical 11:00 a.m. Eastern time slot to maximize
Well,
attendance.
yeah, they obsess over it.
But Bradley is actively hunting for the dead zones. He's looking for the friction.
And the marketing. I mean, it is a masterclass in what not to do. He's promising bad graphics. He is planning confusing sign-up links that don't quite work right.
Links that just go nowhere.
Yeah. He wants live sessions that absolutely nobody will attend. But my absolute favorite detail from the recording, the one that made me actually laugh out loud while I was listening, is his strategy for the pricing model.
Oh, the pricing is the best part.
He says they need to have pricing, but it should be weird. So the VIP pricing will actually cost less than the basic pricing.
It completely breaks the consumer's mental model of value.
It really does.
We are so conditioned to the, you know, good, better, best tiered pricing models that seeing the VIP tier priced the cheapest creates genuine cognitive dissonance.
I actually have an analogy for this because I was trying to wrap my head around the sheer effort involved in doing this so badly.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
This feels exactly like a restaurant actively trying to earn 0 stars on Yelp.
Oh, totally.
Like, they don't just happen to have a bad chef, right?
Yeah.
They are intentionally designing a hostile culinary experience.
Right, they're working at it.
They are serving your soup in a shoe. They are serving your dessert on a muddy frisbee.
And charging you more for a glass of tap water than they are for a bottle of vintage wine.
Exactly. So I have to ask you, is this level of intentional self-sabotage actually harder to design than just putting on a mediocre, normal event?
You know, if we connect this to the bigger picture of online business and marketing, yes, it absolutely is harder.
Really?
Yeah. And that's where the bizarre brilliance of his pitch comes in. By perfectly inverting the standard best practices, Bradley is highlighting just how arbitrary and stressful those rules often are.
Oh, that makes sense.
Think about how much time you or I, or anyone listening, might spend agonizing over a landing page design.
Too much time.
Tweaking the specific hex code colors of a buy now button, or making sure a VIP tier has exactly 3 more bullet points of value than the basic tier.
It's exhausting just thinking about it, honestly. People spend months on that stuff before they ever launch a single piece of actual content.
Exactly.
They get trapped in the optimization phase before there's even anything to optimize.
That is the trap. The industry has accidentally built this massive barrier to entry made entirely of quote-unquote best practices.
Right.
It's a wall of perceived prerequisites. By actively designing a confusing pricing tier or terrible pixelated graphics, Bradley is turning that entire stressful paradigm into a playground.
A playground.
Yeah. He's saying, look how silly these rules are when we put them in reverse. It requires a very high level of awareness to know exactly which levers to pull in the wrong direction to guarantee a failure.
It's like you have to be an absolute master of the rules before you can break them this thoroughly. So he's built this masterpiece of a disaster. But nobody spends this much time engineering a train wreck just for the fun of it, right?
No, there's a real purpose.
There is a psychological engine driving this entire elliptical machine pitch. Why build this 0-star event in the first place? Because according to the source material, this isn't just a prank. It clears a very specific psychological runway for what comes next.
This is a crucial point. This is not a standalone event. The worst summit ever is highly strategic.
Right.
It is the designated kickoff for a whole upcoming season of what he calls repossible summits.
Repossible, which is such an interesting word.
It really is.
From the context of his work, it's this idea of taking things we've given up on, things we thought were impossible for us, and making them possible again, repossibling them.
Yeah.
And the topics for these future summits are intense. They're profound, positive, and honestly, a little vulnerable.
Very.
He mentions future summits focusing on the creative process, stage presence, speaking, voice, laughter, romance, love, and lightness. He specifically mentions wanting to do a love summit and a lightness summit.
And these are not light, breezy topics to tackle if you are a creator.
No, not at all.
Talking about love or your creative voice or romance that requires putting your authentic self out there for the world to judge.
Yeah, that's scary.
The stakes feel incredibly high when you are dealing with matters of the heart or deep creative expression.
So his core philosophy here, as he states on the recording, is that rather than kicking off this deeply vulnerable series with something amazing, he wants to get the worst one out of the way first.
Right.
If you start with something intentionally terrible, you are suddenly immune to failure. Every single summit that follows the love summit, the creative summit, is mathematically guaranteed to be better by comparison.
He is deliberately setting the baseline at absolute zero.
Okay, but wait, I have to push back on this concept a little bit. I hear what you're saying, but isn't making something intentionally bad just another, maybe more clever form of procrastination?
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Like, is he just shielding himself from genuine critique by putting up this massive deflector shield and saying, hey, I meant to do that?
Right.
If someone criticizes the bad graphics, he can just laugh and say that was the plan. Isn't that just hiding from the real work of making a good summit?
This raises an important question, and it's a very fair critique. It definitely looks like a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
But But if we look closer at the psychology of what he's doing, it's actually the exact opposite of hiding. It is a direct assault on the paralysis of perfectionism.
The paralysis of perfectionism.
Yes.
Is that what happens when your taste, your vision of what you want the project to be is so much higher than your actual skill level that you just freeze up and refuse to start?
Exactly.
Like, you know what a good summit looks like, but you are terrified you can't build one, so you just do nothing.
That is a brilliant way to phrase it. Yes. Think about you, the listener, or anyone who has ever stared at a blank page or an empty project file.
Oh, we've all been there.
We don't procrastinate because we are lazy. We procrastinate because that gap between our high taste and our current ability is terrifying.
It is terrifying.
We are afraid that our very best effort simply won't be good enough to meet our own standards, let alone the world's standards. So we wait.
We wait for the perfect moment, the perfect burst of inspiration. We wait until we have a better microphone or a better logo.
And that perfect moment never comes.
No.
By making failure the explicit stated goal, Bradley entirely removes that friction. It's like a cognitive bait and switch.
Oh, a cognitive bait and switch.
Yeah. He is throwing his inner critic a decoy to attack. The terrible graphics, the bad timing, the backward pricing.
Right.
So that his actual creative momentum can slip past the gates entirely unnoticed.
Oh.
The inner critic says, "This graphic looks terrible." Bradley's framework allows him to say, "Perfect. That means I'm succeeding at my goal of making it terrible."
That is so smart.
He is tricking his brain into taking action by lowering the stakes to the floor. It's not shielding himself from critique. It's short-circuiting the fear that prevents him from entering the arena in the first place.
Wow. Okay, when you frame it like that as a cognitive bait and switch, it makes so much sense. By making the goal failure, you literally cannot fail.
Exactly.
It's a psychological safety net woven entirely out of bad ideas. So now that we understand the deep psychology of why he's doing this to get the runway clear, let's look at the actual content he is proposing for this summit.
Yes, let's.
And the meta message of where he actually recorded this pitch, because the content itself is essentially an anti-curriculum.
It is entirely focused on what not to do. He isn't just going to put up bad graphics and call it a day.
Yeah.
The actual substance of the event is dedicated to dissecting failure itself.
He gives some amazing examples of what this content looks like.
Yeah.
He plans to feature things like a 487-point checklist before you get started.
Which is just so painfully accurate.
Painfully accurate to how we delay things. We convince ourselves we just need to tick off a few more boxes.
Yeah, we need more book.
Take one more course, buy one more piece of software before we are finally ready.
Yep.
He also mentions putting up a calendar of someday to mock how people infinitely delay their goals to some magical future date that doesn't exist.
What's fascinating here is the lineup of guests he wants to bring in to navigate this anti-curriculum.
Oh, right.
He specifically mentions wanting to bring in people who have had big, spectacular failures in the online and creative space to share their missteps. But he doesn't want to stop there.
No.
He also wants to bring in actual psychologists to discuss the empirical studies on failure, success, and how the human brain processes both.
And comedy. Don't forget the comedy. He explicitly says he wants to get comedian Rich Robinson to do some stand-up and essentially MC the entire disaster.
Right.
He wants humor to be a core pillar of this thing. But, I mean, why that specific combination? Why do you need a comedian and a psychologist to talk about a bad webinar?
Because analyzing failure requires a very specific toolkit.
Mm.
Primarily because of the emotional weight of shame.
Shame.
Yeah. When we fail, especially publicly, our brains flood with shame, which is an evolutionary mechanism designed to make us hide from the tribe. Mm. We don't want to look at our failures. We bury them.
Right. If you mess up a big presentation, you don't want to dissect it. You just want to go home, get under the covers, and never think about it again.
Exactly. So to actually study failure, you have to bypass that shame reflex. The psychologist provides clinical distance. They can explain the neuromechanisms of what went wrong without judgment, turning a personal failing into a fascinating data point.
That makes sense.
But that clinical approach can still be heavy. That is where the comedian comes in. Laughter is a neurological reset.
Oh, a reset.
A comedian breaks the tension of shame by making it a shared, absurd human experience. By combining people who have failed, psychologists who study it, and a comedian to MC it, Bradley is creating a safe, shame-free laboratory to examine our worst instincts.
That is such a profound mix for an event. It turns failure from a source of trauma into a source of entertainment and education.
It really does.
And it brings me to my next point. The overarching mantra of his entire recording, repeated through the heavy breathing, is this phrase, "Go knows what to do."
Yes, Go knows what to do.
And the setting where he recorded this is just so perfectly aligned with that message. He is literally on an elliptical machine. He makes a point to say, am I at the computer? Am I using AI? Am I researching this? No.
He just hit record.
He just hit record while he was sweating.
He is living the methodology he is pitching in real time. It is a philosophy of embodied cognition.
Embodied cognition. Explain that, because it feels like he's saying the physical act of starting is more important than the mental act of planning.
That is precisely it. We often think that clarity leads to action. We think, once I figure out exactly what this project should be or what this business plan should look like, then I will start typing.
Right. We wait for the blueprint.
Go knows what to do flits that entirely. It suggests that action precedes clarity. The physical act of moving, whether it's sweating on an elliptical or just typing a terrible first sentence, generates the momentum that your brain needs to figure out the next step.
Wow.
You can't steer a parked car. You have to be moving first.
You have to be moving. He didn't wait to be perfectly lit at his desk with a scripted outline. He just started. Which leads me to a big question for you.
Go for it.
Could a completely disastrous, deeply honest event like the one he is planning, paradoxically, be more valuable to the attendee than a polished, perfectly executed corporate webinar?
If we connect this to how adults actually learn, the answer is a resounding yes.
Really?
There is a concept in learning called inversion. It's the idea that studying what goes wrong is often far more memorable and instructive than studying what goes right.
Because right often looks invisible, doesn't it? It just looks like things are naturally working effortlessly.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but our brains are evolutionarily hardwired to remember failures more vividly than successes.
That makes sense.
If an ancient human ate a berry that tasted fine, they might forget it.
Yeah.
If they ate a berry that made them violently ill, that failure is permanently etched into their memory so they survive next time. We learn through negative constraints.
So when you watch a polished corporate webinar, you are seeing the final sanitized product. You don't see the messy decisions, the wrong turns, or the near disasters that got them there.
Right.
It's not actionable because it hides the reality of the process.
And that polished final product can actually increase your imposter syndrome.
Oh, absolutely.
You look at it and think, I could never do that.
Yeah.
But an event that openly dissects a 487-point checklist of what not to do, that holds up a mirror to the attendee's own bad habits.
Yeah.
It creates a shared communal experience of vulnerability. It says, we all do these dumb things to delay our dreams. Let's laugh at it. Let's understand the psychology behind it. And then let's get to work.
So by putting on a seemingly terrible event, he's actually delivering an incredibly high-value masterclass in overcoming self-doubt. He's weaponizing failure to teach resilience.
And he proves his own point by the very existence of the audio recording. He didn't let the lack of a microphone or a quiet room stop him from capturing the idea.
Right.
Trusting that Go knows what to do.
Right.
Means trusting that momentum will guide you.
It's just so refreshing in a world obsessed with curation. So what does this all mean for you listening to this deep dive right now? Let's bring this home and summarize the core takeaway.
Let's do it.
Whether you are stuck on building an online course, writing a presentation for your boss, painting a canvas, or launching any kind of creative endeavor, maybe your biggest roadblock isn't a lack of skill or a lack of time. Maybe your biggest roadblock is that you are trying to make it perfect on the first try.
The expectation of immediate excellence is the ultimate enemy of action.
So maybe, taking a page out of Bradley Charbonneau's mid-June elliptical epiphany, you shouldn't try to make it perfect today.
Yep.
Maybe you need to sit down right now and intentionally plan your own worst project ever.
I love that.
Write the absolute worst, most cliche-ridden first page of your novel. Code the buggiest, ugliest, most unuser-friendly version of your app. Design the most confusing presentation slide you can possibly imagine. Use it as a tool to break the seal.
Break the seal.
Once you get the worst one out of the way, every single thing you do after that is mathematically guaranteed to be an improvement.
You build an immunity to the fear of starting. You throw that decoy to your inner critic. And you clear the runway for the work that actually matters, the work you were deeply scared to do.
I love that. And it leaves us with something really important to think about as we wrap up today. We spend our whole lives being taught that perfectionism is this noble high standard that we hold ourselves to. It's the acceptable weakness we always brag about in job interviews, right? Oh, my biggest flaw is I'm just too much of a perfectionist. I care too much.
We've all said it.
But looking at Bradley's approach, it forces a completely different perspective.
It entirely reframes what perfectionism actually is.
It does. It leaves you wondering, what if perfectionism isn't a high standard at all? What if perfectionism is actually just a socially acceptable excuse for hiding?
Wow.
Think about that for a second. If perfectionism is just a sophisticated way of refusing to show up and be seen, then doing everything wrong on purpose takes real guts. What if, today, your absolute worst, messiest, most unpolished effort is actually the most courageous thing you can offer the world?
It's a powerful thought.
Because at least you're not sitting in the symphony waiting for the conductor to tell you it's safe to play. You're the guy panting on the elliptical, annoying the neighbors, but finally hitting record.